This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
BFM 89.9, I'm Sharad Kutin. With me, Brian Fernandez. Welcome. It is the 21st of August, just after 6 o'clock. And did you have a good weekend, Brian?
Yes, it was fantastic, actually. Just quite a relaxing weekend. Quick trip to Singapore as well. And into wonderful weather in Marina Bay.
Wonderful weather, really. Okay. Well, here in Kuala Lumpur, we had, because the Kuala Lumpur Festival, which is a kind of festival of arts and ideas, and that was quite a lot of BFMers, because the chief organizer of that is Uma Pagan Ambike Pakin of the Evening Edition. So that was going on over the weekend. We also had sessions on journalism, especially on the Friday.
And how was the turnout for that?
Well, I think the turnout was pretty good. It really depends on what your expectations are. And, it's a small market, I think, in Kuala Lumpur for these kinds of festivals, but one that's quite committed and very involved. So interesting, because part of the theme of the festival was, the future, and a lot of science fiction writers, a lot of people speculating as to where the planet was going.
So, that's interesting. KL, science fiction writers.
Yeah, absolutely. So, in fact, over the weekend, you would have read that Nature magazine now speculates that the planetary takeover by ocean-dwelling algae some 650 million years ago transformed life on Earth. So that's a major theory on how there was that initial push for life on Earth. And now, human beings are doing their best to end life on Earth.
Yes, we are.
Speaking about the end of life, comedian Jerry Lewis died overnight at the age of 91. Brian, did you grow up with Jerry Lewis as a comedian?
Yes, absolutely. We are old enough, you go far back, Jerry Lewis and Dean Martin were like the pair.
They were indeed, yeah.
But I realized that I just did a little bit of reading about Jerry Lewis. It's a lot more than a comedian. He was a singer, a songwriter, philanthropist in some ways. So it's sad to see the passing of these icons.
Yeah, but it was a generation. He had a great life. It seems like he had a good run of it. I don't know, I can't quite remember when Dean Martin passed away. But Jerry Lewis there, dead at 91. Speaking of death, Catholic Church has come out strongly against Filipino President Duterte for his campaign against so-called drug dealers, which has claimed over 3,000 lives in the last 14 months. What reports are suggesting is it's not just the main kingpins who are being targeted, but just ordinary folk who, for whatever personal failings that they might have, are involved in drugs. So drug takers, basically.
Yeah, not only that, Sharad, there have been criticism, especially by the church, that the clampdown against drug dealers has been used by the police as well to cover up indiscretions by the police. So literally to cover their tracks, so to speak.
So they're killing people who otherwise might expose their wrongdoing.
Absolutely.
Okay. So all that coming up, and we're going to be talking about a huge amount of things this morning, because it's going to be an exciting morning. We're taking you all the way up to 10 o'clock this morning. Stay tuned. Now we have Cream and White Room, BFM 89.9. BFM 89.9, that was White Room by Cream. I'm Sharad Kutin, with me, Brian Fernandez, and welcome to the morning round. We're taking up all the way up to 10 a.m. in the morning with a really astounding, if I might say so myself, a lineup of interviews and discussions. We're going to continue with something that we found on Bloomberg, Brian, which has got to do with changing trends in terms of not just food, but also woodworking, all kinds of skills that used to be the province of amateurs, right? So amateurs would get into it, they would cook, or they would get involved in carpentry and make a chair or something. And you'd forgive them for all kinds of inadequacies because they were amateurs, right? And now what's happened is, because of YouTube, because you can Google just about anything and do anything and learn it on YouTube, just because of especially when it comes to food, food, you know, all those cooking shows, the level of expectation has risen, not just among the amateurs who are actually involved, but also those on the receiving end. So the person who sits in the chair, as well as someone who eats. The question really is, and it's being posed by this article, which we're going to tweet out, is whether this aficionado culture is destroying the fun of just getting involved in things.
But you see, so here's the thing. Let's take us back a little bit to Malcolm Gladwell and his whole theory of 10,000 hours. So his theory is basically that if you spend, to really master something, you need to spend at least 10,000 hours on it. And this aficionado culture actually is taking hobbies to that direction. Now, people are spending more and more times on their hobby, more and more time on their hobby, and it's something that's driven by passion. So when you're passionate about something, you tend to spend a lot more time on it, and you try to perfect your craft, even because it's a hobby, and you want to show off to your fellow hobbyists and so forth.
But what about what happens when, say, for instance, that the level of expectation goes, kind of like, you know, creeps into the province of professionals, right? So if you watch any kind of food show, the kind of skills that are demonstrated by those getting involved is really very high. And also the expectation is that you are well aware of several cooking traditions, right? So the cuisine that's presented could range from Indian to French to Mesoamerican. I mean, it just becomes bewildering. And you're expected to know not just the food, but the ingredients, and understand their, you know, flavor, profile, and all kinds of things. In fact, I mean, the expression flavor profile is something I've learned just from watching cooking shows, unfortunately, too frequently.
Do you cook a lot, Chirag?
I try to cook, but I must say I'm a really quite bad at it, though I come from a family of really good cooks. And I think what I was taught is, yes, I mean, practice is the most important thing. In fact, I remember my father who would practice on us. So basically, he would be trying to perfect a dish, and he would present it on day one. We all thought, oh, quite nice. And then day two, and then day three, or day four, depending
on consecutively, you're the guinea pig. So consecutively, he'd try to improve the dish.
Yeah, because it's all about muscle memory, right? And it's all about sort of developing a deeper sense of the taste and, you know, and all that of the dish and how to get the best out of it. So he was committed to it because this was post-retirement. So, you know, I think the argument in the piece, which we'll tweet out, is that once you have this kind of kicking in, it really does take the joy out of it. Though, and that's an argument that's made, the flip side is it's actually made food much better.
So here's the thing, taking the joy out of it, I'm basically one of those people who have turned off food shows because of that. Now, I used to love to cook. I learned to cook in university. I couldn't boil an egg before I left Malaysia. But the thing is this, and I became quite good at cooking, but it's all these cooking shows and the quest for perfection has kind of turned me off away from cooking shows. I still cook to eat, and I enjoy the presenting of white plates. And, you know, I literally dab the plate to make sure that it's clean and stuff like that and well presented. But I've turned off watching cooking shows because exactly what you said.
Well, you know, coming back to your Malcolm Gladwell and his famous 10,000 hour rule, I think there you have, the basis for becoming a professional, becoming really good at something. And not this is not about amateur hour, right? This 10,000 hours is not about just being kind of good at something. This is about becoming super at something. And, you know, I think with him, and we look at all kinds of life stories, including this, and I remember reading a book called The 70s when it talks about Martin Scorsese and his, you know, future partner who were in film school, and they watched just about everything. I mean, this idea of being completely immersed, completely committed to whatever craft or skill that you are committed to. It's amazing, right? You need that to become super special, not just to become good enough to serve your friends on the weekend.
No, but so here's the thing. You find that there are a lot of weekend warriors like me who cycle. A lot of guys now have taken it really to a different level because they want to outdo each other over the weekends, they're training almost every day. And these are 40-year-old guys or some even in their 50s. But they're training like they're professional athletes just because, again, quest for perfection.
Absolutely wonderful. Okay, after these ads, we have a cold chisel with Flame Trees, BFM 89.9. BFM 89.9, that was Cold Chisel and Flame Trees, I'm sure. Couldn't with me, Brian Fernandez, and the Morning Run continues. It's just 21 minutes past 6 and on the 21st of August. And we're coming up, of course, to Merdeka celebrations at the end of the month. And we just had the opening ceremony, and I don't know when the closing ceremony for the SEA Games is, but we certainly did have the opening ceremony of the weekend.
Yeah. Did you watch it? It was supposed to be spectacular.
Yes, it was, but I am not a big fan of opening closing ceremonies of any kind of big sporting event.
Join the club, not even the Olympics, not even the World Cup.
Yeah, okay. Now, recently, over the weekend, Brian, we had news of three Malaysian students who, when visiting Japan, found themselves in a bit of a spot. So a kind-hearted Italian owner of a bread and breakfast took them on. And because the place that he had house rules that the kids, these are not kids, they're adults actually, disagreed with, they threw a tantrum. Unfortunately for the three young men, who are all Malaysians, all their antics were caught on video and were then subsequently uploaded because they abused the person who was running the place, who was the manager, who happened to be a Malaysian as well. And they also punched a wall and caused a crack, and also defecated in the toilet as an act of contempt towards the person who had actually reached out and helped them. And what's happened is the owner has since not only put it on social media but also made a police report. And since then, one of the three has come back and apologized and said they're willing to pay for the damage and such. But it seems like it's one of those situations that perhaps if there wasn't a social media dimension to it, these three young men would have just gone on into the world thinking that they were entitled to do something like that. And I wonder, if this is the makings of, the ugly Malaysian abroad, feeling entitled, being ungrateful when, in fact, kindness is, shown to them. And I'm wondering where this comes from.
No, I'm actually very, very embarrassed. And when I read that story, and it brought back, my thoughts about Chinese tourists and how now, because they're coming from second-tier cities, they're traveling for the first time abroad, they're loud, they're perceived to be obnoxious and so forth. And their fellow Chinese are actually embarrassed by their behaviour. Spitting, defecating in public. When I was living in Singapore, we had issues of Chinese tourists literally getting their kids to defecate in the corner.
So the kids, not the adults.
Yeah, not the adults. But just really, really, as a nation, you would be very embarrassed. And I'm very, very embarrassed by these three young men.
Yeah, and you and a whole lot of people on social media who criticize these three young men. In fact, when reading the apology, it's quite interesting that the apology, at least is reported, begins with one of them saying, "I'm sorry to Malaysians." And then also Kayum, who is the guy who they abused, who was managing the hostel. And so you think, I see myself, why is it that he's apologizing to Malaysians as opposed to the
Italian owner? Exactly.
Or the Japanese people or whatever it is that you made. But it is clearly because that's where the anger is coming from. It's coming from a fellow Malaysians who think not only is this behavior bad, but this behavior and the reputation it will leave for the rest of us, we're all going to be, it's like, oh my God, it's not a Malaysian. Like, I'm sorry, the inn is full, because you present your Malaysian passport. Because if we get a reputation as bad tourists, it rebounds on all of us.
That's exactly what will happen. But the thing is, Sharad, it comes back also from and now my perception that the apology is in fact not driven by a deep sense of remorse, but really because of pressure from social media. That upsets me even more. It's the entitlement culture from this gentleman.
Okay, and then also there's the question of the police report. So while those three individuals have left Japan, they might be facing a situation where they might not be able to return to Japan, or they'll have to be taken to the police station. Anyway, we're coming up to the to 6:30 because we're going to have our first bulletin. But before that, Sheryl Crow and Every Day is a Winding Road at BFM 89.9. BFM 89.9, that was Peter Green and Seven Stars. I'm sure it couldn't with me, Brian Fernandez. It's just 40 minutes after 6 on the 21st of August. And thank you, Samuel Tan, for tweeting in. I'd forgotten when the closing ceremony of the SEA Games is. It's on the 30th of this month, just the day before Madeka. So tune in to that. If the opening ceremony is anything to go by, at least by, you know, all the hoopla around it, it should be quite a spectacle when the games close. Now, speaking of spectacles, Brian, over the weekend we had one of a rat video. This is not a video of clever rats, but perhaps clever, because they're jumping about across a series of pans serving food to customers at a cafeteria at Tunku Ampuan Rahimah Hospital in Klang. The video, needless to say, caused outrage. The cafeteria was closed in the morning, and then at 10 p.m. that same day, it was reopened, and according to the director of the hospital, Dr. Ding Lei Ming, the Klang District Health Office had given the cafeteria a pass. Now, if you read the story on Malaysia Kini, which comes from Bernama, by the way, whatever I read out to just now, you will read in the comments section such derisive and mocking statements about where governance is in Malaysia. And the question is, so if you'd read this and then, you know, and seen the video, Brian, and you knew the cafeteria had been closed, but then it reopened that same night, given a clean bill of health, would you rush with your family there to have a tasty meal?
Yeah, what do you think? Absolutely not. I basically wouldn't touch it with a 10-foot pole.
Why not? Because the Department of Health had already given it a clean bill.
So, okay, as someone who has worked in various kitchens, when I was in university, I did lots of different hospitality-related stuff. So washing dishes, preparing crabs, you know, cleaning crabs, all that stuff as a kitchen hand, and also working in fine dining. So I've done the whole gamut, including a stint in McDonald's.
Yeah, and Brian is available for all kinds of parties, especially on weekends.
And I can still hold two or three plates with one hand. But the thing is this, and I did all this stuff in Australia, and they were very, very particular about cleanliness. It's the, you know, McDonald's, they teach you clean as you go. You know, everything knows. And I remember my manager used to tell me the floor needs to be clean enough that you could eat off it.
Okay, so why wouldn't you go back to this cafeteria? It's been given a clean bill of health, Brian.
Yeah, because it takes time to basically disinfect the whole place. You've got to get rid of the rats. You've got to clean all the surfaces with disinfectant.
Maybe it was done in double quick time, which is what, you know, a lot of the people who wrote in think. It was like, well, this is extraordinarily speedy. And of course, there are all these other people who had conspiracy theories about who owned the cafeteria and what vested interest, business interest, and maybe they even linked to a political party. I mean, all kinds of things.
But how do you get rid of these? What I'm puzzled is this. They got a clean bill of health. How did these clever rodents run away so quickly? That
maybe they were caught. Maybe they were caught. Who knows? Maybe they were enticed with great food. But the point is this. Isn't there, in some sense, a kind of real trust deficit? And the trust deficit gets deeper and widens because of the way in which people in authority act, right? So instead of being cautious, instead of recognizing that this quick turnaround will not inspire confidence, but do quite the opposite, which is to get people to think, what happened here? Why isn't enough time being taken to deal with the problem?
Right? Now, not only that, Sharad, the very fact that this happened in a hospital also should send alarm bells. Happened at a hospital that you had poor hygiene conditions. Apparently, the operator had been warned several times before already. Secondly, the fact that it was given a clean bill of health in a hospital so quickly, that's another thing that's shocker.
So what do you think would, if you were in charge, what would you do?
Well, basically, it will take, you know, you've got to, as I said earlier, disinfect the whole place. You've got to bring cleaners in. It shouldn't be done. And you pest control as well. You need to get the pest control people in.
Would you keep it closed for a couple of days just for the sake of showing that you've done your utmost to make sure that it's clean?
I think it's got to be closed for the time that's necessary to get an exterminator in.
But then the people in authorities will say, well, we did all that. That was sufficient.
Well, we'll leave it at that, huh?
Yeah, we'll leave it at that. Now, after these messages, The Who with My Generation, BFM 89.9. BFM 89.9, that was The Who with My Generation. I'm Sharad Kutan with me, Brian Fernandez. It's just 51 minutes, coming up 52 minutes after 6. And of course, this is the 21st of August, start of the new week for all of us. It's a Monday. Brian, of course, over the weekend, we had the SEA Games and a lot of, you know, kudos to the organizers for that opening ceremony. But then there was the flag flap, as it were, the flag flap, which had to do with an error in printing on the booklet for that opening ceremony that had the Indonesian flag upside down. Now, of course, if you're not familiar with the Indonesian flag, it's just two bands, white and red. It's a Merah Putih, as they call it. But we got it upside down. Now, this, of course, caused a lot of consternation among Indonesians and, of course, I think a major embarrassment for the Malaysians, whether they're the organizers, just ordinary Malaysians. We always feel embarrassed by the things that other Malaysians do. and of course, you know, as we reported on the bulletin just now, you would have heard President Joko Widodo of Indonesia has come out to say to his fellow countrymen, don't make too much of this, though he's asked for a formal apology from the organizers. And also, so we had news, this is reported in Channel News Asia, that the SEA Games organizers are going to reprint the booklet, which means, of course, additional costs, though it seems like the right thing to do. Do you think, because there's been quite a bit of a storm around this, Brian, that as some people suggest, the minister should step down, or are we overreacting?
Yeah, as usual, overreacting.
Do you think so? Do you think it's overreaction?
Okay, so let me put it. Minister should step down, that's overreacting. We should apologize, that's absolutely the right thing to do. Officially, we should be doing that. What shocks me is for such a major event like this, that something like this has slipped through the cracks. Isn't there 3, 4, 5 sets of eyes going through the final proof with a fine-tooth comb before it goes through the printers?
Yeah, you think that, you know, okay, you know, you can anticipate the kind of boo-boos that would be majorly embarrassing for any kind of organizer, right? Misspelling a name, having the image, the incorrect image, right? So you have people there checking. I mean, this is not the Olympics, right? There aren't, you know, 140 whatever countries involved. This is really just the Southeast Asian nations, you know?
Absolutely. And the proofreading or checking this is really simple. You take an old document with all the flags, you look at it and you say, ah, okay, that's fine. Does this match? And any child should be able to do the matching.
Okay, there's also this old question of the second flap, which had to do with the flag again. But I think this was at one of those events where the Brunei flag, it wasn't the Brunei flag that was used. It was, I think, a flag of the Brunei Navy that was used. But again, the lack of care. And I'm wondering about this, this promise to reprint the booklet. Who is going to bear the cost?
Of course, it's a taxpayer. No one else.
Why do you say that? I know you mean that kind of ironically. Yeah. That in fact, at the end of the day, nobody's held accountable for these errors, and it's the taxpayer that bears the burden.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's a shocking thing that this happened in the first place. So embarrassing. As a Malaysian, I'm so embarrassed.
Okay, you continue to be embarrassed in your corner there. While we listen to Ned's Atomic Dustbin, and Not Sleeping Around, BFM 89.9. Good morning, I'm Sharad Kutan, with me, Brian Fernandez. It's coming up to 8 minutes past 7 on the 21st of August. It's a Monday, it's start of a new week, reason to be excited. The weekend, next weekend, not the coming weekend, but the weekend after, because it's going to be a long weekend, another reason to celebrate, maybe a bit prematurely.
Now, yes, that's a week from now. You're taking a long countdown, aren't you, Sharad?
Absolutely. I think that's the only way to approach life. Now, a recent poll suggests that Malaysian employers and employees are more pessimistic about the job market compared to our Southeast Asian neighbours. The survey was conducted by JobStreet, the leading job portal of the region. BFM spoke to its country manager, Chuk Yun Ying, to ask her about why we are so pessimistic.
So in general, all the Southeast Asian countries are showing a more negative sentiment overall. Of course, in comparison to the six countries that we actually surveyed, Malaysia will be, you know, the bottom half in terms of the scores. As to why we are a little bit more negative, I think that probably Malaysians are maybe a little bit more pessimistic, but definitely we're not the most negative. I think Singapore will you know, be kind of the bottom of the pile. But having said that, I do want to mention that this is based on the sentiment of both the candidates and HARA. So in actual fact, we do not see a corresponding trend in the number of job posting that we have seen this year compared to last year. So in context of the number of job posting on JobStreet, January to July compared to the same period last year, we've actually seen an increase of 6%. So the job market itself is still holding on. In fact, it's grown a little bit.
So we asked her about the differences across industries in terms of sentiment and the actual job market conditions.
Yeah, so in terms of the actual job outlook, so we do see that actually most of the industries have positive growth. In the top 10 industries, with exception of banking and financial services, which has gone down a little bit, the education segment, which has gone up quite a bit last year, so, you know, it's gone down a little bit this year, and also telco, which has gone down slightly. But, you know, the bigger industries like manufacturing, construction, retail, IT, property, healthcare, they've all shown signs of growth in the first 7 months of the year.
You know, Brian, we talk about this kind of disconnect in terms of sentiment and actual conditions on the ground. So, and it seems to be a continuing theme. Now, we're going to ask her, we did ask her also to elaborate on precisely this disconnect between sentiment and the job market.
I guess if we look at the impact, so in terms of the actual job posting or job vacancy growth, it does not kind of seem to have any negative impact because it continued to grow. But I would think that maybe with a clearer outlook like this, employers or candidates have, you know, slightly more negative outlook, we'll actually see this as positive because, you know, we are seeing a growth, actual growth, you know, in terms of, you know, the job market. So I guess, you know, maybe it's time to kind of reconsider the hiring plans if that has not been put to consideration yet.
That was JobStreet's country manager, Chuk Yun Yang, speaking about a survey done by JobStreet recently about sentiment towards the job markets. It seems that Malaysian employers and employees converging on the same point of pessimism, despite actual conditions.
So, again, we've talked about this, as you mentioned, in our business segments over the last few weeks. Our macro numbers are very, very good. Strong export growth, strong GDP growth. You've got tourism numbers that are coming in. We've got new engines of growth. Oil prices are basically relatively in line with our $45 budget estimates. So all these are all, even people like the IMF, Morgan Stanley and all have rated us, you know, very, very well in terms of, and have basically revised our growth upwards. Our growth numbers just in were 5.8%, which were very close to the top end of estimates.
Right. So you can talk yourself blue in the face on how good things are, and yet there is pessimism on the ground. And if you actually, from kind of anecdotal evidence, people talk about the GST, there are also issues of liquidity problems and payments, and there are problems. Perhaps those things are the ones that are fueling the pessimism. Because where else is the pessimism coming from if not from some facts on the ground, unless we think that people are delusional?
No, I think also one of the things with economics is this. The macro factors for it to translate down into on-the-ground realities, normally, traditionally, they say it takes 2 to 3 quarters for it to to translate downwards. So I think we haven't felt the effects on the ground yet.
Yeah, in fact, you know, we have also the story in many countries where you can have fairly robust GDP growth, but no jobs growth. And I think that's a problem, say, that India is having. And, you know, and this this might be another issue as well. So, as you said, maybe it's a question of time for this to translate. But what would you say to a young person who's coming into the job market today with this kind of pessimism, maybe shared by peers and even people who are potentially hiring?
I think, you see, it tends to be self-defeating. If you think, for example, there are no jobs out there and you're a young person in particular, so you're an entry-level person, I think you're going to have a challenge because mentally you've already defeated. So what you really need to do is to go out there with an optimistic mind and be very focused in terms of who you apply to. Now, if you've got a degree in English, don't apply for a job that basically requires an economics degree. That's not going to happen. A lot of young graduates or young people.
Do you think there's a kind of mismatch that people are actually applying for the wrong jobs?
Yeah, I think so, because if you look at any HR person, you talk to any HR person, you see the number of unrelated job applications for online jobs in particular, because it's so easy now on an app. You're sitting in the train, say, oh, this job looks interesting. And then they just press apply and their CV is basically sent, say, via JobStreet or LinkedIn or whatever job portal they're using. And basically, this is filtered out. They think they've applied for a job and they think that's good enough. It's not like the old days where you've got to put it in an envelope and send it off and then tick the box and say, ah, I sent it off to this company and with a cover letter and so forth. Now it's so easy.
So too easy, you say?
Too easy. So they think they've applied for 200 jobs. The reality is they probably qualified for two.
Okay, we'll be back with more news and analysis after this at BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.